if you're following along in the hymnals, to, not that one. O God, our help in ages past, 203 voices to God.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jeff Taylor, and I'll be leading us in worship this morning, together with song leader Tim Neufeld and instrumentalist DM LaFortune, Sandra Horst, and Adriel Sloss. So far, maybe more. As well as reader and presenters Maggie Lepp, Eli Schmucker, and Joanne Piloya. Brad Lepp is our tech chief today, and our ushers are Laura Monroe and Madeline Arias. Marika Meyer and Thane Ladner are serving coffee and tea after the service in the main lobby. And the children will be cared for during activity time by Christine and Andrew Sloss. Every week we are served by the same two pastors. But it does seem that I sounded disappointed, didn't I? Sorry about that. But it seems good and practical that we should all know who they are in case we should wish to speak to one of them. In our church, neither pastor is a senior in either rank or full-time equivalencies. So how to introduce them then? I considered alphabetically by middle name. But I have chosen instead, on this occasion anyway, to introduce them in order of their most recent Duolingo scores in 2nd century BCE Hurro-Urartanian. Look it up. So just slightly ahead is Pastor Christina Reimer, who's here, followed very closely by Pastor Peter Hairsnape. These are the pastors that serve our congregation. This morning, one of our preachers, Tim Schmucker, will finally reveal the true nature of the modern zombie apocalypse and its relationship to the revelation of Jesus the Christ. Welcome to Toronto United Mennonite Church. Some of you must be thinking that I was kidding, but then you remembered that it is Tim who is preaching. I'm not kidding about that theme. In this service, you will hear actual Bible verses, at least two of them, refer to someone no longer dead, and it's not the risen Jesus or Lazarus. So get ready for that. There are many things that we could celebrate today. Today is a day of international and national celebration of the Indigenous people of the world and of Canada, which probably not surprisingly happens on the first day of the summer solstice. That's when we have a really long day and a short night. So there we go. And also it's Father's Day. It's other stuff as well. There's something else going on today, but there's a number of events that we could celebrate. We're going with zombies, so there you are. Whoever you are today, wherever you've come from, whatever's going on in your life, hopefully not too much of a zombie problem, no matter who you love or how you identify, no matter your ethnic origin, accent, or faith background, no matter how vibrant your faith or how persistent your doubts, there is room for you here. We're not even in the neighborhood of perfect, but we aspire to be a faith community that brings people together to worship God and support each other while working to fulfill Jesus' call and example of gardening peace, justice, and love into being. You are beloved by God, and you are welcome here. Now, we do have a tradition of making space for those who consider themselves new or new-ish to us to be introduced or to introduce themselves, if you would like. We'll give you that totally optional opportunity in just a moment when I'll ask ushers to bring a mic to anyone who raises their hand to make an introduction. Those of you joining us on the cloud who'd like to introduce themselves, you can simply do that by entering your name or saying hello in the chat feature that I think will be at the bottom of your screen, and that will give Brad an opportunity to let us know that you're letting us know that you're here with us today. So, do we have any willing newcomers who'd like to introduce themselves or be introduced? We do have some. Excellent.
Hi, I'm Ness. I'm a third year at University of Toronto. I'm originally from Waterloo, moved to Toronto for university, and I missed my Mennonite community, so here I am.
Thank you. And you don't live right in the neighborhood here either, do you?
Yes, I go to the University of Toronto, Scarborough.
Scarborough, there we go. Yes.
Some lovely trails if you're ever there.
Thank you, welcome. There are others, I think. I saw Toby's hand up.
Hi, I'm Toby, and my cousin Susan Van is visiting from Saskatoon.
Welcome. Great to have you. Are there others here in the room? Brad, do we have anybody? Nobody's introducing themselves online. So, again, you are all welcome here. We'll make a reconciliation statement. We sometimes call these things land acknowledgments, and they are that certainly. But I think the problems that we have go beyond who's on what land. we'll make that statement. If you'll allow me, I'll make it on our behalf, and you can enter it in the way that you want to. We recognize that all who live in this space many call Canada live on land long cared for by the first peoples of this land, including the Anishinaabeg, the Huron-Wendat people, and the peoples of the New Credit, as well as many others whose names may now be lost to us, but whom our great Creator remembers. We who are new settlers or who have settler ancestry are beholden to our First Nations sisters and brothers who walked gently on this land for thousands of years, and we are obliged to work for restoration of our relationship with the first peoples of this land and with the land itself which mothered us into being. That's not a spiritual statement, that's actually a scientific statement. Talk to me and we'll discuss. Now, we do often perform a call to worship in which we read together or responsively, and you would have something on the slide. There isn't one for you this morning. If that's okay, I'm just going to read a short call to worship for all of us. I'll do the calling, I suppose. And I'm using a resource from our own songbook. Let's pray. From all that is broken, let there be beauty. From what is torn, jagged, ripped, frayed, let there be not just mending, but meetings unimagined. May the God in whom nothing is wasted gather up every scrap, every shred and shard, and make of them new paths, new doorways, new worlds. We'll consider continue our worship with singing.
We'll sing "As the Waters Rise Around Us," hymn number 708 in Voices Together, and it will be on the slide above me. And this one, I think we may have sung once or twice. It's a little bit tricky to do, so what I'm going to ask is as Sandra to actually play it through once, and I've asked Brad if he could just advance the slides as it goes so you could kind of pair the melody to what you're about to see, and then we'll back the slides up to the beginning and sing through. As you're able, and we'll let the slides reset.
Thank you.
we do various kinds of sharing here, and one of the ways in which we share is with our many gifts. You can see we've been recently... It's a child. They cry. They don't know what else to do. Okay. As soon as they learn some language, you'll be better at this. So, yeah, but then they have ideas, too, once they learn those languages. So, 50-50. One of the ways we share is with our gifts of service. One of the reasons some of your worship leaders have recently begun to name a number of the people that are generally otherwise just listed in our bulletin, well, our online bulletin, shall I say, is because we just want you to know these things don't just happen. People do them, and you know that because you're the people doing them. So we are grateful for all of the acts of service and kindness. We do have to pay for stuff around here. I'm afraid most of the people that we need light and buildings and, you know, pens and pencils from do not work in a gift economy. So we have bills to pay and so forth, and you are generous in helping us do those sorts of things and extend our ministry well beyond these walls as well. So there's a couple ways you can do that. There's a slide there just indicating that there's a lovely... Pardon me, lovely dark wooden box between those glass doors at the back where you can put cash and checks and those sorts of things. Or you can make an e-transfer to treasurer at tumsi.ca. And if you are wanting to set up a regular sort of deposit system, that could be done too. You should speak to our treasurer, Toby Thiessen. Again, you can reach her at treasurer at tumsi.ca. Let's say a short prayer of gratitude for the gifts of this church and to this church. Holy One, we are grateful for the many, many, many personal gifts that we find here among us and the generosity of people to do things seen and unseen that make the lives of all of us here and well beyond this place better, more holy, filled with the holiness of peace and comfort and so forth. We're glad to be able to do these things, and we recognize that everything that we have, every gift of ability and money and time is a gift that we have from you, and we give it back to you in gratitude. Amen. It looks like I organized this so I could do everything I have to do at the beginning and then get... That's not what the plan was, but it turns out it is. So there are two scriptures to be presented this morning. One will be presented by a company of people, and you'll encounter that later, but then I'm going to begin with this reading from the Revelation, the book of Revelation. Some Christian traditions call it the Apocalypse, and you'll hear more about that later, I'm sure. This is from Revelation chapter 13, and this is an old man, John, probably the same guy that wrote the Gospel of John, definitely not the Baptist and probably not the disciple. And we may be a good 100 years into the new millennium here at this point. And he's being given a revelation from Jesus. And he says, "Then I saw another beast coming up from the earth." This makes you want to go back and find out about the previous beasts, does it not? It had two horns like a lamb, okay, nothing unusual there, but it was speaking like a dragon. It exercised all the authority of the first beast in its presence. It also makes the earth and those who live in it worship the first beast, whose fatal wound was healed. Fatal wound was healed. That normally doesn't happen if it's fatal. It does great signs so that it even makes fire come down from the heaven to earth in the presence of the people. It deceives those who live on earth by the signs that it was allowed to do in the presence of the beast. It told those who live on earth to make an image for the beast who had been wounded by the sword and yet come back to life again. It was allowed to give breath to the beast's image so that the beast's image would even speak and cause anyone who didn't worship the beast's image to be put to death. It forces everyone, the small and great, the rich and the poor, the free and the slaves, to have a mark put on their right hand or on their forehead. It will not allow anyone to make a purchase or sell anything unless that person has the mark with the beast's name or the number of its name. It's odd. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who understands calculate the beast's number, for it's a human being's number. The number is 666. Children, you may be terrified, I promise. The children's story will be actually quite interesting, I think, for you. So, children, you're welcome to come and join us on the blanket here. And this morning, if we have some of the older young people with us, junior high folks, if some of you are here, you'd be welcome to join us. I think you could help us out. Something with this sand here in just a moment or two, and then after the service I will do some monitored sand time with you as well, okay? And I'll give you the rules about that a little bit later. Can you all sit down so that others can see past you? Thank you so much. All right, so it is play sand. I didn't go get it at a beach, but I'll bet the people who put it in bags and sold it to us got it from our beaches. Yes, I don't know where else it would come from, actually. So friends, is there anything special going on in Canada these days? Any sporting events at all that are interesting? Yes, what are the sporting events? The FIFA, is that something to do with football? One of those Fs must be for football, right? As in soccer? Sir?
Soccer.
Soccer, so yes. So we in Canada, we often use the word soccer. Around the world, people who are speaking English often call it football. And have you noticed anybody driving around with anything weird waving on their cars? Yes, dear, what have you seen? You've seen flags on people's cars. What do those flags tell us? Here, have any of you seen anybody with that flag on their car? And what does this tell us? These people are cheering for who? You've answered once, love. They're cheering for Canada if they have that flag. Probably so. Or maybe they just want us to know they're in Canada or they like Canada or whatever. We don't know for sure. How about if they have this flag? What does this flag symbolize about some people? Does anybody know this one?
Go ahead.
These could be people from Brazil or people supporting a Brazilian team in some way or other. Yes, and there are people here supporting Brazilian teams, including those who have lived in Brazil, possibly. And let's see. Oh, I've got one that might be a little harder, not just because it's... this may not be the only one with these colors. You think you know? It's actually not Portuguese.
Sir,
that is the flag of Italy, yes. And some people cheer in our city for the teams that are, represent the city of the country of Italy. Some of our people, pardon me? Who regularly, normally, I don't care, I watch hockey. Sorry, the adults are giving me a hard time, and I'm giving it right back to them. All right, folks, help me out. This flag here, Pastor Christina wants to make sure we all know which one this is. Yes, dear. That is the flag of Germany. I think maybe she is partial to that team. Well, people use all sorts of symbols to tell you something about who they are. Oh, you know, I helped out Pastor Christina there. I should really help the other pastor out a little bit. Pastor Peter is not much of a nationalist. Yes, what flag is that? Well, the flag of the United Kingdom, yes, England. It's complicated, right? England, the United Kingdom, Great Britain. We'll sort that out sometime. Ask Pastor Peter. He likes to talk about it. All right, now, I have a symbol for you that is not just colors. It's actually of something you might recognize. And all I have to do is look at the symbol and tell me if you recognize what this animal might be. What animal is this? It could be a duck, and honestly, that's what it looks like to me. But take a look at this little plant over by its beak. This is a very ancient drawing. This was drawn in stone. It was hard to get it perfect. What do you think it might be? You think it's a dove. And how did you know it's a dove? Oh, well, you were right. You did a great job guessing. By the way, guessing is your brain's way of saying you know the answer even though you don't know why you know the answer. So just say it. It is a dove, and it has, what is that plant that it's almost holding in its beak? A better artist might have had it in its beak. Yes. It is an olive branch. Now, you don't say that because you personally harvest olives from olive trees very often. Is that right? No. So there's some story about doves and olive branches? Who remembers that? What that story is? Yes, dear.
Like these people were on a boat.
Yes. Yes. Yes, that's right. These people went on to some guy named Noah's boat, and he was eager to find out if the water was receding so they could land somewhere. And a dove eventually came back with a branch from an olive tree, meaning the dove was able to reach a tree, meaning it's getting better. Yes. How about... Now, this symbol, I'd be very surprised if anybody knows this symbol. Maybe you think you know who the person is, but look at the letters or the symbols on either side of that person's head. They're letters, but they're not in English.
Can we
speak? No. If I were a better person, yes, but I didn't get to that point. Those are two letters from the Greek alphabet. The first one looks like an A, doesn't it? And that's an alpha, and the one at the end is not a Z or anything like a Z. It's an omega, and believe it or not, in Greek, that's the last letter. This is saying first and last. So when it says first and last, who do you think maybe is the person drawn in between the first and the last letters? If it's a symbol, if it means something about that person, who could it be? You know, it could be Jesus. That's a very strong possibility. We don't know because, you know, there's no photographs of the man. I'm going to guess you do not know what this means. Probably very few of us do, but you do, apparently. Go for it. It's what? Oh, take a chance. We give Google like 3 or 4 chances to get the right hit. How come you only get one? If you come up with it later, tell me. Yeah, this one's very hard. It's also letters that we have in the English alphabet. In English, it looks like a big P with an X over top of it. But they're not English, they're Greek, and it's a K and a R. It's a Kairo, a K, R, which is the first sounds of the word Christ. And again, it's a symbol about Jesus. Why do you think ancient Christians who used rocks for art, why do you think they made symbols for Jesus instead of just saying, hey, I worship Jesus? Okay, well, you're going to get to be in the sand for a second. Young lady, can you be not in the sand? I didn't say everybody jump in the sand. No, no, not yet. You back up. I need two volunteers who are somewhat older. Okay, you can be one. The other. There we go. You two folks come forward. Now, you don't have to do anything awkward or weird. One of you stands on this side of the sand. I'm going to turn this around a little bit. Do you let me do this, please? Thank you. You can stand right there. You can come over and stand right on this side. Okay. Now, you two have just met. No, nobody else can be in the sand right now. Sweetheart, you've got to back up or somebody's going to come and get you. Hopefully not a zombie. All right. Now, you two have just met, and you're not sure if it's safe to tell this person that you worship Jesus, because the government doesn't want you to. And you're not sure if it's safe to tell this person that you worship Jesus because your government doesn't want you to. In fact, they might do some terrible things to you if you admit it. How are you going to find out each other is both? How are you going to find out that you both worship Jesus? Girls. Girls. Thank you. I don't want it in somebody's eyes or something, okay? It can hurt you. All right, so now here's what you can do. You're going to take your foot, while you're talking, you just casually take your foot, one of them, and you're going to make a line that goes that way. You just wait. You're going to make a line with your toe, let's say, just your toe, and just goes like that way. All right. Now, I'm going to ask you to make it a little bit more archy, like a little less straight and a little bit more curved. So can you like go like that? Oh, yeah. All right, now, guess what you're going to do? Do you have a guess? The opposite mirror image, you're going to do that way with the foot. Okay, there you go. Just use your... All right, now, so you guys have made a shape something like this and then like this, yeah? Anybody who wants to answer, does that look like any kind of an animal? Yes. It looks like a fish. The first guess was fish. You guys were successful in saying fish in the sand. So now you've told each other that you both like eating fish. No, that's not what you've said. You've actually said the word ichthus, and I know it sounds icky. Ichthus is a Greek word meaning fish. Okay, but it also can be a symbol. I'll show you the symbol. You can sit down. Thank you very much. You guys did a great job. We'll do this real quick. Right, so, whoops. Here we go. I even color-coded this for you. All these words down on this side are Greek words, if you can read. If you can read English, all these words down this side are English. Okay? On this side, we have ichthus, which means fish. On this side, we have five words that come from the five letters of the word ichthus. I-X-T-H-U-S. I even color-coded them, so you can see they are up in the top words. Sorry, I've got this ridiculous pad thing I have to use here. See how that's color-coded ichthus? All of those letters start another word. Does anybody know what kind of puzzle that is when each letter of some word starts other words? An anagram? Well, this is an anagram, and it says Jesus Christus Theus Huius Soteron, which means nothing to us. But in English, it means Jesus Christ, God's Son, was there a second ago, Savior. Okay, it moved, yeah. Thank you, you're right. I won't worry about that formatting right now. It's an anagram. You guys drew an anagram that didn't just say fish. It said Jesus Christ, God's Son, Savior. And that's how you told each other that you both worship Jesus. And hopefully neither of you are Romans who somehow knew that. Hopefully the Romans haven't caught on yet. You'll hear about the Romans later. Now, we looked at a number of symbols of Jesus. But there's one that we didn't look at. And it's kind of strange because we have it right here in our church. There's a symbol for being a Jesus person that is in our church. Does anybody know what that symbol might be? How about some of the kids on this side? And yes, dear. That thing up there, yes, what do we call that? A cross. I did not show you any symbols of a cross yet, did I? Did you know that Christians did not use that as a symbol of their faith for the more than 300 years since Jesus went up into the clouds? They did not use that as a symbol of the Christian faith. Why do you think they might not wanted to have used that as a symbol of Christianity, sir? Does that cross have something to do with the death of Jesus? In that what? Just say it. Oh, yeah, he died because they hung him up on one of those things, much bigger than that one. And we won't go into the details because that is quite sad. But when he died, 3 days before he became undead, that was used. That was the instrument of Roman torture. So you can easily see why Christians might not have used that as a symbol of their faith, but at some time, all of a sudden, we started to. And I'm not going to give you that history lesson this morning, okay? But the adults are going to sing a song about that, and you guys get to go to activity period with the Slosses. And they are ready for you. So, any special instructions for these guys? Okay, you follow the Slosses. If you're going to activity time, if you're going back to your parents, you go back to your parents. Thank you very much, kids.
Let us sing together hymn 308, How Can We Worship Caesar's Cross?
The sermon this morning has three parts. First, an introduction, which is what I'm doing now. Then a scripture presentation. And then third, the sermon continues. To begin, I need your help. Let's play the word association game, brainstorming. I will say a word and you blurt out the first thing that comes into your mind. Just shout it out. We don't have to take turns. Ready? Revelation, first book of the Bible. What immediately comes to your mind? Shout it out.
Yes.
Brad, next slide, please. When was the last time you heard a sermon on Revelation? Have you ever heard a sermon on Revelation? I have avoided even reading it for my entire adult life. Now, another brainstorming. Shout out whatever comes to mind. Ready? Zombie apocalypse.
Movies.
Movies. You guys are great. Brad, next slide, please. Although you may find it hard to believe, Revelation and zombies have a lot in common. Let's start with Revelation. The title of the very last book of the Bible, Revelation, comes from the very first word of that book. And that first word is apocalypsis, the Greek word, apocalypsis. So the book of Revelation could just as easily be titled apocalypsis. Imagine you learned the books of the Bible when you were in Sunday school, the books of the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans, Corinthians, yada, yada, apocalypse. Revelation is an apocalypse. But what does this mean? So the meaning of apocalypse, that's where we're going to start. Not so long ago, here in North America, you probably, some of you will remember, a common wedding ritual was for the bride to wear a veil covering her face. And then at a certain point in the ceremony, the groom would raise up the veil, revealing her face to her soon-to-be husband. Incredibly, that was the same practice 2,000 years ago in Greek and Roman weddings. And the Greek word for this action, wait for it, apocalypse. Apocalypsis simply means the unveiling or the revealing of what had been hidden or obscured. Just as the bride's veil, when removed, reveals her fully to her husband, so too did apocalypsis reveal a previously obscure reality to their audiences. So apocalyptic writings are acts of unveiling, of truth-telling. They reveal the deeper reality of a present crisis and its near future. In that sense, they are prophetic. But they're not predictions about events thousands of years later. Rather, Revelation speaks to the immediate circumstances of its original audience living under Roman rule. Now, Judean apocalyptic theology emerged during centuries of foreign domination, when they struggled to reconcile God's promises with the apparent triumph of oppressive governments, empires. And the apocalyptic answer was quite bold. Empire would not have the final word. God would. So through fantastical imagery and symbols, otherworldly creatures and heavenly visions, Revelation proclaims that evil will be exposed and justice will ultimately prevail through God's miraculous intervention. John, and we don't know who John was, wrote Revelation as a letter to the seven congregations of Asia Minor. Most of its content is a series of visions, apocalyptic visions, prophetic visions, unveiling and truth-telling about the present and the looming future. Although there was no widespread Roman persecution of Christians at that time, social exclusion was quite prevalent. So John was pointing out and warning about a crisis he saw on the horizon, a crisis of identity, a crisis of faith. And when John wrote about Babylon, as we're soon going to hear, he wasn't talking about ancient Babylon. His audiences knew that. It's like the writing in the sand. Babylon was the code word for Rome, the Roman Empire. So Maggie, Eli, Joanne, and I are going to present chapter 18 of Revelation. While they are coming up, I want to name a jarring aspect of this chapter. John uses the image of a debased wicked woman, a prostitute, to symbolize the Babylonian and Roman empires' violent system of domination. However, given male violence against women over many millennia, this metaphor is deeply unfortunate. Today, we can understand the historic metaphor for empire, idolatry, and seduction. But let's also shout out loudly that this image should never be used or even tolerated in our 21st century context. So we invite you to listen carefully. The book of Revelation was written to be heard by its audience, not read, heard. So the text will not be projected. So listen. What do you hear? What is John, the author of Revelation, unveiling and revealing? Are your microphones on? Check to make sure your microphone's on.
Check.
Yeah.
Well.
Chapter 18. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined by his presence. He called out with a mighty voice,
"Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, as became a dwelling place of demons, a haunt of every foul spirit, a haunt of every foul bird, a haunt of every foul and hateful beast. For all the nations have drunk from the wine of the wrath of her prostitution, and the kings of the earth have engaged in prostitution with her. And the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxury."
Then I heard another voice from heaven saying,
"Come out of her, my people, so that you do not take part in her sins, so that you do not share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render to her as herself has rendered, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double dose for her in the cup she mixed, as she glorified herself and lived luxuriously. So give her a like measure of torment and grief, since in her heart she says, 'I rule as a queen, I am no widow, and I will never see grief.' Therefore her plagues will come in a single day, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her."
And the kings of the earth who engaged in prostitution and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say,
"Alas, alas, the great city, Babylon, the mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come."
And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet, all kinds of scented wood, all articles of ivory, all articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, olive oil, flour, and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, slaves, and human lives.
The fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you, and all your delicacies and splendor are lost to you, never to be found again.
The merchants of these wares, who grew wealthy from her, will stand far off, in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud.
"Alas, alas, the great city, clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels and with pearls, for in 1 hour all this wealth has been laid waste."
And all the shipmasters and seafarers, sailors and all whose trade is on the sea, stood far off and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning,
"What city was like the great city?"
And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out,
"Alas, alas, the great city, where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she has been laid waste."
"Rejoice over her, O heaven, you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has condemned her condemnation of you."
Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying,
"With such violence, Babylon, the great city, will be thrown down and will be found in you no more. and the sound of harpists and entertainers and of flutists and trumpeters will be heard in you no more, and an artisan of any trade will be found in you no more, and the sound of the millstone will be heard in you no more, and the light of a lamp will shine in you no more, and the voice of bridegroom and bride will be heard in you no more.
For your merchants were the magnates of earth, and all nations were deceived by your sorcery, and in you was found the blood of prophets and of saints, and of all who have been slaughtered on earth.
Chapter 18 of Revelation is a full-on celebration of the fall of the oppressive Roman Empire. What John sees when the veil is pulled back is gripping and disturbing. He sees an empire that appears glorious and prosperous on the surface, but whose opulent wealth depends on widespread extraction, exploitation, and suffering. Babylon is dressed in luxurious purple and scarlet, glittering with gold and jewels. She looks magnificent. But John is announcing that Babylon has fallen. The empire has collapsed. He hears merchants and traders weeping because Babylon is no more. They are weeping because their abundant profits have disappeared. The ship captains and their crews are also wailing. They transported luxury goods and food from across the Mediterranean Sea, from all the vassal states to Rome. But now they are wailing because their lucrative work is gone. These empire collaborators had gotten wealthy. Now they're unemployed. John lists all the cargo on these ships. The list includes many luxury items for jewelry, furniture, and ornamentation. Then food staples, such as wine, olive oil, grain, livestock. These food items strikingly illustrate the gaping inequality of the Roman extractive economy. The empire assured the supply of food staples for its core Roman population, at the expense of the margins. For example, 200,000 families in Rome every day received a free supply of grain. However, the outlying provinces and vassal states who produced these staples had to pay extraordinarily high prices for them. And at some times there was nothing available due to the demand at the empire center. The faraway shelves were empty due to Rome's parasitic, luxurious lifestyle. The image is almost cinematic. Imagine John on the island there at Patmos, watching the ships move across the sea, carrying the wealth of the Mediterranean entire world and beyond toward Rome, the center of the empire. Resources flow from every corner of the empire toward a single destination. And then comes the most chilling item on the cargo list, slaves and human lives. Women and men have become commodities, slaves and human lives, just cargo. John is writing to the seven congregations because he wants them to recognize that the splendor of the empire is built upon the suffering of others. Rome's abundance did not simply appear out of nowhere, nor did they produce it. No, it was extracted from the margins of the empire, from the provinces and their people. That was the economic system. Wealth flows inward, power flows outward, and military force and violence enforce the system, making possible a lavish life that most people at the center regarded as normal. And the uncomfortable reality for John's congregations is that they are entangled in this Roman economic system. Some suffer under it, others benefit greatly from it. Many do both. And that is why Revelation is an apocalypse. It reveals, it unveils, and invites hearers to listen. No, it insists that we see. Almost 900 years later, another apocalypse appeared. Not a biblical apocalypse this time, but a zombie apocalypse. Some of you may remember George Romero's 1978 film, Dawn of the Dead. His previous film, Night of the Walking Dead, pioneered the zombie apocalypse movie genre. Now, the zombie had its origins in Haiti, but it was nothing like what came to be known in North America. In Haiti, the zombie expressed the Haitian fear of being re-enslaved and losing their identity. But anyway, the Dawn of the Dead zombie apocalypse begins with society in total collapse due to a zombie outbreak. The dead are all returning to life with a mindless and incessant drive to consume flesh, and civilization is falling apart. During mass hysteria, four survivors escape and find refuge in a shopping mall by barricading themselves inside. They then become seduced by the dazzling array of products everywhere. They wander through the stores, giddy with all the material abundance there, and they continue to block all the entrances so that they can keep the mall's wonders for themselves. Meanwhile, the zombie hordes shuffle swarm towards the mall, as if programmed to do so by their former selves, because the shopping mall was the pinnacle of their life when they were alive. Romero's satire is merciless. Even after death, the zombies are still consumers. They are drawn instinctively towards the temple of consumption. The living dead wander shuffle throughout a shopping mall. One of the survivors, bitten by a zombie and becoming one, is nevertheless, with his shopping cart overflowing, he is elated with his sacrifice to the god of consumption. "We did it, didn't we? We got it all," he exclaims. Romero is asking a profoundly apocalyptic question. What if consumerism is not merely something we do? What if it becomes something that shapes us, becomes core to our identity? What if we are so formed by the habits of acquisition and consumption that we no longer notice them, notice the habits? What if we spend our entire lives pursuing abundance, but never stop to ask who produces it and at what cost? And whether that abundance of stuff makes us more alive, more fully human, or not. Just as John did in Revelation, Romero is pulling back the veil, an apocalypse. He is revealing what lies beneath the surface of a society organized around consumption. And this brings us to Jason Hickel. I actually mentioned him in a sermon a year ago or so. Hickel is a world-renowned economic anthropologist, professor, and a prolific writer. He was born and raised in Swaziland as an MK, as a missionary kid. His parents were called by the Lord, that's what his dad said, to serve in southern Africa as medical missionaries. While Jason does not publicly claim Christian faith, it seems to me that his upbringing echoes throughout his work. For example, his best-selling book in 2020 is entitled Less is More. Less is more, more with less. Well, I have to say that his parents were not Mennonite, but rather faithful Catholics. In any case, Hickel does not write apocalyptic literature in the ancient sense, yet his work achieves this very similar function. It unveils. It reveals truths that we would rather remain hidden. He asks uncomfortable questions like, how is wealth created? Why does poverty persist? Why do some countries seem permanently trapped in insurmountable debt while others accumulate lavish wealth? Why does the global economy continue lurching towards ecological destruction even when we know the consequences of catastrophic climate change? Hickel shows how contemporary global capitalism has many of the same characteristics that John in Revelation identified in the Roman Empire. Wealth flows disproportionately from the global south towards the powerful centers of the global north. Labor and resources are extracted from poor regions and sent to the wealthy centers. Political and military power work together to maintain the system. And like John in Revelation, Hickel invites us to look beneath appearances. He challenges the narratives that tell us that everything is fine when our country's economic indicators are solid. Like John, he shows how an oppressive and unjust system becomes so normalized that we stop noticing it altogether. So then how then shall we live? Given the massive injustice of the global economic system that we benefit from, and given the looming environmental apocalypse, what do we do? And where do we find hope? I'd like to say that this morning that Romero's zombie apocalypse, while a poignant picture of truth clearly unveiled, offers us nothing. There is nothing in his zombie apocalypse that we humans can do other than to protect ourselves for a little bit. And that's even futile. All is lost. There is no hope in the zombie apocalypse. John's answer in Revelation is quite different, and yet ultimately I find his hope inadequate also. His message has two prophetic parts. First, wake up and pay attention. Several of his congregations in Revelation have become quite comfortable. The wealthy of these churches, as we see in chapter 3, you can read it this afternoon, have flourished in the Roman Empire economy and have become complacent. This has left them unaware of their spiritual poverty, John declares, and they've lost their faith identity. So John's first step towards faithfulness and hope is learning to see clearly. And his second step is action, a very specific kind of action. He calls his communities of Jesus followers to disentangle themselves from imperial systems that diminish human life. He says that resisting empire oppression requires removing themselves from the empire's evil. Benefiting from and living off the suffering of others, he says, cannot continue. And that remains a challenge for us today. We are one of the most wealthiest societies in human history, and we are entangled in this system. Many of us benefit daily from an economic system that we didn't design. We don't even fully understand how it works. And so John's question becomes our question. What forms of suffering remain invisible because they are far away? What costs are hidden behind our comforts? Who grows our food? Who produces the dazzling array of products in our malls, or rather on Amazon? Who sews our clothes? Who mines the minerals in our computers and cell phones? Who bears the consequences of environmental degradation? Then John's third step. His third step is intrinsically related to the previous one. Ultimately, followers of Jesus are to wait in anticipation for God's intervention and liberation. In first century Judean Christian apocalyptic faith, God will intervene miraculously in human history to overthrow oppressive empires, thus vindicating the faithful and establishing a new creation marked by justice and peace. Wait for God. And that's what's not satisfying to me. Because once the veil has been lifted, we cannot remain innocent bystanders. We have choices to make, whether we like it or not. And this is where Jason Hickel's work becomes crucial. Unlike John in Revelation, Jason does not have us wait for God's dramatic, miraculous intervention. His hope lies in human communities choosing new paths based on fairness and sharing. One of Jason's foundation is the biblical practice of Jubilee, and he proposes many pathways toward a fairer world system. Some are grassroots oriented, while others require governmental legislation. Underlying Hickel's pathways is a phrase that I find deeply compelling. He advocates for a transformation in our attitudes toward what we as communities and human beings need. He calls it radical abundance. Radical abundance rejects what our society tells us, that abundance comes through more production and more growth and more consumption. Instead, he says that there's enough for all. Enough for all when we organize society around sharing, when we ensure that everyone's basic needs are met, when we value care, human care, community, health care, time, ecological well-being, more than we value economic output statistics. And that is where I find hope this morning. Not in superficial optimism, not in the assumption that everything will work out fine or that God ultimately will rescue us. Hope begins with seeing clearly. Hope grows then when communities refuse to accept exploitation as normal. Hope emerges when people imagine alternatives. Hope takes shape when human beings choose generosity over accumulation, cooperation over competition, sufficiency over excess, solidarity over indifference. There is enough for all. John, Romero, and Hickel each offer an apocalypse, unveiling a world hidden beneath the surface. But once the veil is lifted, we are not to simply observe. We are invited to respond, to live differently, to imagine differently, to build differently, and to participate in the creation of a world economy marked by justice, jubilee, and radical abundance. There's enough for all. Will we share it? How will we respond to the apocalypse?
Thank you, Tim. Let us begin by responding with a hymn. 416, Beyond a Dying Sun. 416, if you're following along in the Purple Voices together, please stand as you're able. Thank you.
have just a couple of announcements, or perhaps a few more. You see a screen that highlights some of those. Christina, Peter, and Aldred each have announcements, so if you'd like to come forward.
Thank you. This Friday, some of us will be gathering for the Trans March, and I wanted to give you some more information on that. The time that I put in the bulletin that went out was 5 p.m. That's actually incorrect. There are activities happening at 5, but the march itself begins at 8 p.m. and it's preceded by a rally at 7 p.m. So I'm going to be present for the rally at 7 p.m. on Friday. Please keep in mind that this will involve standing and walking. It takes place at Hayden Street, which is close to Church and Bloor. Sherburn is the closest subway station. I'm still working out the exact specifics of this with some organizers from other churches. So the updated information will be in the Friday noon announcement email. But if you would like to attend, please feel free to let me know, and I can give you information a little earlier in the week. Thank you.
This summer, there's, for those of you with children, you may might be interested in this. St. Clair O'Connor is offering a summer camp, an intergenerational summer camp. Pardon me. There's posters in the hallway, so it's for kids 7 to 12 years, kids with seniors mixed. There was a pilot of this last year. That seemed to work quite well, so now they're expanding it. So if you're interested at all, there are posters in the back.
Hello. There are certain things that we assume everyone knows in this church, and it's good to remind ourselves of some of those things that some of us have forgotten, and some of us, it might be new to you. And so I just wanted to make a quick announcement about how our washrooms work. We have a number of washrooms in this building. The main washrooms are in the basement, and they are accessible by the stairs or by an elevator. Now that means you do have to wait for a second for the elevator to come. So there is a time issue there. There's a small washroom in the nursery that the children frequent when they're using that room. And we also have an accessible washroom at the back of this floor. And accessibility in this case means that we try to prioritize people with physical needs and challenges so that they can have this bathroom free to use when they need it. And so let's always remember that there are sometimes folks, whether we see them or not, that need this washroom as a priority before others. So if at all possible, please use the basement washrooms and use the elevator if the stairs are difficult for you. Thank you.
This Wednesday at 10 o'clock, there's going to be the multi-faith walk against poverty. It starts at City Hall and it goes around and it ends up at Nathan Phillips Square. That's the same building, I guess. So. And just, it starts at 10 and we should end back. It's like the stations we used to do on Good Friday. We're doing one of those on Wednesday. And we'll end up with a music rally at noon at Nathan Phillips Square.
This morning we will sing our benediction.
There's more love somewhere, 804. Please stand.